Welcome to this podcast from Adelaide Place Baptist Church. We are a community of disciples, apprentices of Jesus, who live and work in the city of Glasgow, and it's our vision to join God in the renewal of all things. Our discipleship to Jesus is for all of our lives, so as well as listening to this podcast, we'd love for you to join us on a Sunday morning or get involved in one of our missional communities, which are across the city throughout the week. Our prayer is that you encounter Jesus in some way through this podcast. More information can be found at apbc.net.
This morning we're beginning a new series called Breaking the Silence. We're going to think about the challenges as disciples of Jesus and what it means to be disciples, have faith in when it comes to problems with mental health, issues of all sorts of descriptions. So we're going to explore that issue this morning. It'll be over the next few weeks. Now, that series will be broken up with a couple of guest speakers you'll be delighted to know over the next month. So that series will be broken up, but there'll be three parts to it, and we're going to begin looking at that this morning. It was either Martin Luther or Martin Luther King or else John Calvin. One of them said this. It's a quote I had just to build confidence right from the start. It's a quote that I've had it and locked away in a notepad for ages, but I couldn't figure out the source of it, but I'm convinced it's one of them. If it's not one of them, I'm just going to have to own it and claim it myself. But it goes like this. It says, "If when preaching the gospel, we fail to address the major issues of our day, we aren't really preaching the gospel at all." If we aren't able to speak about the gospel and bring the gospel to bear on the realities of what we face in the challenges of mental health, John Calvin or Martin Luther or me or somebody has said, we're not really preaching the gospel at all. There's something interesting about that. We sing, you've probably sung this many times, that's a great hymn, "It is well with my soul." I love it, it's one of my favorite. "It is well with my soul." We sing it often. But the challenge to me seems to be, what do we do when it is not well with our soul? What to do then? Do we just keep singing? Singing louder, stronger? Or do we attend to something else? And this is one of the challenges. So today we're just going to look at the layout of the land of the problem, the challenge, and look at some of the realities of our mental health, our mental illness, and just look at some of the realities that's going on pretty much in our country. The next time we look at this, it'll be next week, we'll look at our response in light of the mission of Jesus. What does the coming of Jesus, the gospel of Jesus and his mission, mean for us, and what would a Christian response look like? And then the third week, when we round off the series, we'll be looking at what would it look like to carry hope among really specific situations? What's the nature of actual hope? And so we will get there. But I want to begin with actual experience and start with reality. And I want to do that each of the weeks we do this. So actually hear stories and experiences of mental health. And in just a few moments, I'm going to invite Myra to share some of her experiences with as mental illness and mental health. And you'll hear from her in a second. But I wanted to start with reality and just to paint a picture of some of the challenges that some of you by now will be very familiar with that are going on, and some stats on our mental health in Scotland. So just listen to some of these. Some will be behind me, but some I will just read out. The most probably well-established now fact for you that you'll probably be aware of is one in four people are affected by problems associated with mental health each year in Scotland. One in four people. So you can imagine in a gathering like this, or even as you look around the bus or the train or look around the office at work, the stats are staggering, and in many ways that's probably an underestimation of the situation. One in four people affected in some way by mental health problems each year. The suicide rate in Scotland is really quite profound in some ways. Although it's reducing, which is good news, there's been a lot in the press over the last year and a lot of raising awareness issues that has actually had an impact, which is absolutely amazing. But the suicide rate trend in Scotland and UK is falling, both in male and female, but it remains high. It remains very high. The UK is a lot higher than other sort of comparative nations of wealth. And Scotland within the UK is higher again. So it spikes up higher than, say, England or Northern Ireland. And so there's something going on, although the trend is going in an encouraging direction. In 2016, around 75% of suicides in Scotland were men. It remains one of the biggest single killers of young men, and a lot of research has shown that, and that has probably become more common knowledge just now, how many lives are taken with young men when it comes to actual suicide. But some of the research is showing from the Office of National Statistics that actually there is an increase, and men in their 40s and 50s are actually becoming the largest demographic when it comes to suicide in this country. They're grappling with why that is, what's going on with that, and guessing things like the economic environment over the last 5 years has probably led to a spike of that age group as the impact, or alcoholism, particularly in Scotland, has had a big impact. Isolation was another factor that was deemed to be relevant in that. And so that's just one aspect of the layout of the land in Scotland and in the UK. Mental Health Awareness Week, which was, and there's Mental Health Awareness Day, and it would have been much clever of me if I could have aligned the two, but we'll hopefully do that next year. It was earlier on in this month, in October, there's World Mental Health Day, and so the Church of England actually have a lot of helpful resources on that, and we'll be drawing on some of those later on in our service. But the focus this year on mental health in 2018 was on stress. That very subtle thing that sometimes we just ignore as pressure and responsibilities build just on top of us, and we just keep telling ourselves we're okay, it's just life, it's just the way it is, and then all of a sudden we just implode. Not designed to carry that much stress, and they're saying how much stress has been the source and cause of anxiety, depression at points, not all the time, at points and at times. And so the question through Mental Health Awareness Week was, are we coping? Really simple question. Are we coping? Are you coping? It's funny when people ask that question, it's, of course, if you're me, there's a part of you that's always going to say yes, no matter what. It was actually just about a year ago. I didn't really actually understand my relationship to stress, which kind of terrified me somewhat. And it took, as a colleague, he's a pastor, he's older than me, so he could probably see some things, but he just caught me off guard when we're just chat, and I can give chat. I can talk all day long if I'm having coffee with you. It's a wonderful experience for those who've not had it. And he just cut me off and he said, are you stressed? And I was like, all the answers to try and say no. And I was like, you could say that. And so it took me, and what I realized, it took me 6 months to realize I was stressed. So I could carry it for 6 months before I'd actually realized I had it. And so stress is a weird thing. It's a wonderful thing. It's not really. There's good stress, but you know, when it starts to pile up, that question about are we coping is really significant. And so the summary of just a cursory glance when you explore the landscape of the issues facing people in Scotland is, this is my summary of just having looked into it over the last few weeks, is there are a whole range of issues when it comes to mental health and mental illnesses. There's a whole spectrum of different things that can be at play, not just the things that I've just mentioned by introduction. There is a whole range of different people who will be affected by it. in lots of different ways. There's no stereotype of the person who has any particular issues with it. One of the things that actually stood out to me more than anything else, particularly when it came to the suicide, was the research shows you could basically flip a coin when it comes to the ability to be able to predict those that will take their lives. Just the people surprise us time and time again who actually end up going and taking their lives. And the net sum of people's experiences at times could be summed up in these three words. People who have had problems with mental health have been misunderstood, they've been isolated, and more often than not, they have felt deep shame for the place they find themselves. And so we need to talk about mental health. We need to talk about it in light of the gospel of Jesus. So I'm going to invite Myra, who's going to be so kind and so brave, just to come just to now to share a wee bit of her experience of walking through and with struggling with depression. And so I'm just going to let Myra share a little bit of her story just now.
Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me all right? Hold it up. I make myself very vulnerable today because I want to share with you my personal struggle with mental illness and particularly with severe clinical depression. Over the years, I found that people didn't know how to respond if I said I had depression. Being told to pull myself together, to snap out of it, or to keep busy, to stop thinking about it, wasn't helpful at all. And I decided today I was going to be open about my depression to show there is nothing to be ashamed of and that with treatment you can recover and lead a useful, productive life. I have had several episodes of severe clinical depression in my life. The first was when I was 14 years old for about 1.5 years. I felt constantly sad and anxious and I cried a lot. Now, in the 1960s, it wasn't talked about, and I didn't actually know what was wrong with me. And I just really rode it out, and it eventually passed. The second more serious episode started after the birth of our daughter in 1978 and lasted for 7 years. I know now it was postnatal depression, and was also linked to a physical back problem I had had since I was 5 months pregnant. I just want to emphasize that each person's experience of depression is an individual journey. No two journeys are the same. This was the hardest, most painful and confusing path I have ever traveled. It was a long, lonely and dark journey. I likened it to a long black tunnel with no light at the end, and I often wondered when and if I would ever come out the other end. I came to realise my self-worth was in my career, I was a primary teacher, and in my church involvements, rather than in God. He loved me for who I was, not because of what I did. And I was a very organised, capable person, liked to just do everything so that it was absolutely right. And when I gave up work to become a full-time mum, I felt I was a nobody. I had lost my identity because it had been in what I did. And I remember the first time I had to fill in a form and it asked for your occupation. And I remember struggling to write down housewife. I had unrealistic expectations of what being a mum was like, and because I couldn't attain this high standard that I thought everybody else had reached, I felt a total failure. I hid it from my family and never visited my GP, because in these days I thought they would take my baby away, and I wasn't able to cope, and I would never see her again. I should have asked my family for help and support on looking back. Things got steadily worse and I started on a downward spiral. To block out the emotional, physical and mental pain, I wanted to sleep all the time, as only then did I experience relief. I lost interest in everything and had no motivation whatsoever. I felt constantly exhausted, no matter how long I slept. And getting out of bed was a struggle. I was unable to cope with everyday tasks, and it permeated my whole life. This shows you how bad it was. Apart from changing my underwear every day, I wore the same skirt and jumper day after day. Washing my hair and taking a shower could take an hour, and I was exhausted afterwards. I couldn't concentrate on anything and was unable to make decisions. I felt total despair and wept and wept. I felt worthless and hopeless. My weight plunged to 7 stone, and I just wanted someone to take over so I didn't have to think of anything, not even to make the tea. Many nights when lying in bed, I looked at the bottle of extremely strong painkillers I had been described, and several times I contemplated taking an overdose. The only thing that stopped me was knowing that Lindsay would grow up without a mum, and that she would discover how her mum had died and the awful impact that that would have on her life. And that was the only thing that stopped me. I felt numb inside, not in touch with my feelings. My sleep patterns became disrupted, and I would wake in the night. I was irritable, and I felt distant and isolated from people. Before this, which I am now, I was a friendly, bubbly, cheery person. Yet if I saw someone I knew, I would dive into a shop or up a lane to avoid talking to them. I couldn't answer the door, and I used to peep out of the curtains to see who was there. As you can imagine, the strain drove a wedge between Colin and I, and cracks started to appear in our marriage. So we had to seek help, and thankfully, with God's help, we overcame the difficulties and grew stronger. Through this experience, I kept crying out to God and looking for answers, but the heavens were like brass. Then God took me on a journey with himself, where he convicted me of my rebellion in trying to live my life in my strength, and miraculously, after 7 years, touched my life in physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual healing. I was totally changed and accepted the truth that my self-worth, security, and significance were all in him and not in what I did. In 1990, I had another episode lasting 5 years, and then 2 more where I was off teaching for 2 separate periods of 6 months. I've had cognitive behavioral therapy. I've seen a psychiatrist. I've been on antidepressants. And it's been a long, hard road at times. But God has shown me a lot about myself. I can now spot the signs that could trigger an episode, and I try to take action. I don't cope with doing too many things at once, and I get stressed. Sometimes I feel the big grey blanket starting to wrap itself around me, and it's as if I feel a mental paralysis. Sometimes I just have to take time out. I think some people may be more vulnerable to depression if they have certain personality traits, low self-esteem, are overly self-critical, or have perfectionist tendencies. Early life experiences or stressful events could be potential triggers. I still take antidepressants every day, and I may have to for the rest of my life. Who knows? But if that helps me to function on a daily basis, so be it. God has been very gracious to me, and as I stand here today, I give him all the glory. I just want to say to you, you don't need to be an expert to help somebody who's suffering from depression. All a depressed person wants is to be listened to, not given advice, not to be told you'll fix it, but to be allowed to verbalise their confusion and pain. But that takes time and commitment, and that's sometimes something that we're not prepared to give.
Thank you, Myra, and appreciate your honesty and sincerity in sharing that with us. So where might we begin addressing this issue a bit further this morning? I want to suggest that we begin by actually thinking about worship, which might seem like a strange place to start, but there is a well-known Old Testament scholar called Walter Brueggemann who's absolutely brilliant, and he's got a really simple structure as he looks at the book of Psalms in the Old Testament. He labels the book of Psalms into largely three categories. There are Psalms of orientation, there are Psalms of disorientation, and Psalms of reorientation. So Psalms of orientation would be like, yay, celebrate, God's good, he's won, he's brilliant, isn't my life amazing, and give thanks to God, you know, 1,000 times. That's the Psalms of orientation, that's how that goes. And the Psalms of disorientation are cries often of lament, of this is not right, this is not the way the world should be. And then there's Psalms of reorientation, where there's a new equilibrium has been found. It's not the old, but it's a new equilibrium, and there's a song of thanksgiving and praise that arises again. Now, the interesting thing about that in worship, if you think about the Psalms as kind of being that voice, that model of here's how you pray to God, here's our holy scriptures, here's how you worship with God, the majority of the Psalms that we find in our Bibles that we have are Psalms of disorientation and Psalms of reorientation. They are not Psalms. There's not more Psalms of orientation. I find that interesting because when we come to worship, actually, what do? Very often, most of the time we come, our framework for worship is that celebration, isn't it? It's that place where we come and say, God, you're good. You set me free. You are the God who saves. You are the God who is in control over all things. How good is our God? And that is a good thing to do, and that is what we love to do that. But there's a problem, I think, whenever if we think of worship, say, as a diet, if we only have one sort of, say, carb-driven diet, we know that's not good for us. But when it comes to worship, if we only have one dimension of worship, God is good, God is amazing, well, there's 1 in 4 people who are going to struggle with that at various points in any given year. There's the risk that those people, it could be us at various different times in any given moment of the year, actually come into that thing where we want to connect with God, but we could end up isolated in worship, even more dislocated, disconnected, and feel shame because it doesn't feel like I have been set free. And so I think we need to talk about worship, and I think that is a place where we need to start. And I'm talking beyond styles, like I'm not talking about contemporary versus, you know, traditional, or hymns versus new songs and choruses, although as Sam said about a month or so ago, the message is the medium, so there's something to be had in that. But I'm not really just talking about that sort of old debate of different ways, the right ways to worship. But I do find it interesting that we were right in the middle of a series on John's gospel, which is all about life. Jesus came to give life and life in all its fullness and abundance. And yet we have to awkwardly go, what does that abundance look like in reality, in this context, in our lives? And I think the psalmist can help us overcome our reluctance to embrace language that expresses disorientation when it is not well with our souls. I think we need it. And I think we need it even if we don't realize we need it or think we want it, because maybe we're like, Joe, I like coming to church because I like the distraction. It, you know, it lifts me. Don't talk about it. If you talk about it, you'll make, you know, there's a feeling of just don't, are we really going to go somewhere where, you know, I just need songs that will lift me, not songs that will make me look at that again. And you know, there's a discipline, there's a place for disciplining ourselves in joy. I think let the highs be higher. Let us learn how to celebrate. Like last week, the people just celebrating Jesus and what they're doing in his life and being baptized. Let's not put a lid on that. Let's just go for it. When it comes to Easter Sunday, you know, bring out the balloons and the goats and the, I don't know why goats, but just bring out everything. And that makes it more, you know, just make the highs higher. Let's do the ordinary time, but let's allow the lows to be real. The space to be real, the contemplative place to be real. And I think the psalmist can help us do that. So the trouble and turmoil in Psalm 13 and also Psalm 88 is what we're going to turn to just now. Psalm 13 is the clearest and shortest example, and I like clear, short, and sharp when it comes to the Psalms of disorientation, a Psalm of lament. There's a really clear pattern that I want to, and I just want to show you one thing from each passage. So from firstly from Psalm 13. I chose Psalm 13 because it's the clearest and most focused. I chose Psalm 88 because there's a portion in it which is the angriest. And so we're going to go after that. Psalm 13 says this: "How long, Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and day after day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? Look on me and answer, Lord my God. Give light to my eyes or I will sleep in death. And my enemy will say, I have overcome him. And my foes will rejoice when I fall. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing the Lord's praise, for he has been good to me." Notice the impatience of the speaker. Four times asks the question, how long? How long? How long? How long? It's just asking, just almost demanding. But what I really want to show you in this is notice how the psalmist draws Yahweh's promise and character into the situation. It says, this is a psalm of David, and he says, I will sleep in death. So this is kind of saying, look what's going to happen to me. I'm going to just rot here. I'm just going to die. But then he does something else. He draws in Yahweh. He puts him at stake. He says, my enemies will say, I have overcome him. This would be defeat for the king, would be defeat for God. And he's saying, that's not what you promised. You don't want that, Yahweh. And then my foes will rejoice when I fall. And they'll rejoice, my foes will rejoice. And so what they'll do, they'll fail to worship you, Yahweh. And so he starts off and he says, look what's going to happen to me. And then he says, look according to your promise. Look according to who you are. And so he draws the character of Yahweh and the promises of Yahweh into this mess. And he asks the question, how long? And then from the, if that's the clearest and the shortest to the angriest, I wanted to read this morning Psalm 88 from the Message. This week, sadly, joyfully in some ways, Eugene Peterson, a great, great theologian, pastor, passed away and went to be with the Lord. And if you know who Eugene Peterson is, he's the one who's written many, many books on so many different topics, but he has one of his biggest gifts to the Christian community is the Message, his translation, his paraphrase of the whole Bible into words that are really accessible that children can read and understand and access. And so he passed away this week. So there's a couple of times I will read from the Message just in honor of Eugene Peterson and the incredible ministry that he has had. Psalm 88, 16 to 18 says this. I'm standing my ground, God, shouting for help. At my prayers every morning, on my knees each daybreak. Why, God, do you turn a deaf ear? Why do you make yourself scarce? For as long as I can remember, I've been hurting. I've taken the worst you can hand out, and I've had it. Your wildfire anger has blazed through my life. I'm bleeding black and blue. You've attacked me fiercely from every side, raining down blows till I'm nearly dead. You made lover and neighbor alike dump me. The only friend I have left is darkness. The psalmist invites a raging honesty that is sometimes lacking to both our private devotion and our public expression. I love reading that. I don't know what your personality type you're like, but see, when it comes to scenarios like you're out for a nice meal and there's a problem with the nice meal and how you handle that problem. Say you need to make a complaint and go to the waiter. If you're me, my dilemma is this. I can go one of two ways. I struggle to steer a middle course. I either go up like I've done many times and I go, no, I'll get this guy to the table, you know, give an air of confidence, and then go to the manager, waiter, and just, you know, go in to do your thing, all ready just to get like £1,000 off the bill and just give them your wrath. And then basically you just start going and slightly intimidate an alpha male or female person. And then I'm like, it was great, it's fine, thanks. And just give them a 50 quid tip and off we go. Go back to the table and say, how do you get on? And I'm like, it's fine, it's good, let's go. And it's a disappointment. Or else, that's what can happen. That probably happens more often. Or the other thing that can happen is there's just no in between. I just go mental. And I'm like, have you ever seen me go mental? It's not mental, but it's mental enough. And you're like, gee whiz, calm down. Do you know what I love about this psalm? It just kind of says, I've always felt, you're wrong to get angry. Like, it's wrong to... This psalm permissions you to be like, I don't care. I am just going to say it as it is. I am just going to describe, name truth, reality, and I'm not even going to overthink what I am just... And it actually gives you the words to say, God, you have just left me in darkness. Everybody else has just got away with it. Everybody else just has life exactly as they want it, not me. Not with the relationship. I've been dumped. I've been left alone. I've had it. Don't domesticate the prayers of the Bible. Don't turn them into little devotional goodies when they are naming all the realities of life. Like Prince Harry, like Michael Carrick, the Manchester United footballer. Yes, I got my team in there. I like to do that once a year in a sermon. Like the psalmist, we need to dare to speak. We need to dare to name our pain. We need to voice our pain, both in the private and also in the public. There is a grave danger when worship functions as a cover-up and fails to deal with reality. I'm not saying that's what we do all the time, but I'm saying it's a grave danger when worship functions as a cover-up and we put on our smiles and we come here and we hide. Walter Brueggemann says this. Let me quote at some length. Just try and take in what he's saying. In most arenas where people live, we are expected and required to speak the language of safe orientation and equilibrium, either to find it so or to pretend we find it so. For the normal conventional functioning of public life, the raw edges of disorientation and reorientation must be denied or suppressed for purposes of public equilibrium. As a result, our speech is dulled and mundane. Our passion has been stilled and is without imagination. And mostly the Holy One is not addressed. Not because we dare not, but because then God is far away and hardly seems important. This means that the agenda and intention of the Psalms is considerably at odds with the normal speech of most people. The normal speech of a stable, functioning, and self-deceptive culture in which everything must be kept running young and smooth. Against that, the speech of the Psalms is abrasive, revolutionary, and dangerous. It announces that life is not like that, that our common experience is not one of well-being and equilibrium, but a churning, disruptive experience of dislocation and relocation. I think he's saying there's a desire, a tendency to truncate the journey or to water down, even if we go down that route of exploring the pain, the Psalms. We are wired, particularly in the public, just to get back to business as usual mode as often and as quick as possible, when actually God has a new equilibrium he wants us to find. But the invitation from Walter Brueggemann through his analysis of human culture and the Psalms is, instead of ignoring the realities of life, is to enter into a journey or a process. The most important thing in the Psalms, particularly clearly seen in Psalm 13, is that there is movement. The prayer moves. The prayer has moves. It's taken you on a journey from plea to praise. But which is hard. There is no shortcuts. There are no waking up tomorrow and just, do you know what? Stephen and the band were really good this week, so my life is going to be really different tomorrow. That happens about once a year anyway, so it's, you know, it's, if you're banking on that, maybe twice. It's a journey. You're invited in a journey. The prayer has moves. And a journey which anticipates Yahweh's intervention, though it never is clear what happens between verses 4 and 5. We don't know. It doesn't tell us what happened. What was the resolution between verse 4 and verse 5, where it suddenly makes it a transition into praise again? We don't know, and at the time the psalmist writes it, he maybe doesn't know how it's going to come. The new equilibrium, the move of God, the help, often comes as a surprise. All the psalmist really knows are the promises of God and the character of Yahweh, and they refuse to settle, and so their prayers of complaint are a bit like Jacob. They wrestle with God, and I think we need to do more of that. I think we need to stir up the Jacob spirituality among us for the people who will wrestle with God, and in their complaint, in their plea, is a prophetic enactment, if you like, that of saying, I'm refusing to let this have the last word. I'm refusing to settle. So there's a journey, there are moves that you're invited to come in with. And just as the psalmist in the particular moments we have read knows that he needs to draw Yahweh into the situation, all the more we have a great high priest through Jesus Christ who invites cries to be heard rather than problems to be solved. The message, again, Eugene Peterson puts Hebrews 4 like this. Now that we know we have Jesus, this great high priest, with ready access to God, let's not let it slip through our fingers. We don't have a high priest who is out of touch with our reality. He's been through weakness and testing, experienced it all but the sin. So let's walk right up to him and get what he is so ready to give. Take the mercy and accept the help. So this Jesus leads us to the Father in heaven who knows the number of hairs on our head. This Jesus will give us his Spirit to be a light, a help, a friend in the darkest of times that we go through and experience. So, what to do now? How are we going to break the silence? And in many ways, I don't want the church to lag behind because people have started to break themselves left, right, and center. It's been wonderful to hear the people I have referenced, the Prince Harrys, whatever you think of royalty, just speak out. And you see the impact people have when they start breaking the silence, naming the things that are going on. We've got to dare to speak. And so I think the first thing we can do is we can be liberated by the language that is already there. We can take the Psalms that are already there and pray them. And use the words to allow our situation to connect us with God in all sorts of different scenarios. We can even move beyond that. As we bring our complaint through the Psalms, we can also just bring our own. Just dare to speak. Hashtag name your pain. And you do that before God, because Jesus is one who understands. And if you've never if you don't know who God is, you've never figured out the Jesus thing, if you've never figured out any of that, you're just here because you're here, you need to know that Jesus is a God who has revealed himself as the one who understands human weakness, who has drawn near. In his incarnation, he came in the flesh because he wanted to draw near. And so you might want to just cry out to God to name your pain. But you do so before the one who identified with our pain. There was a speaker at the Baptist Assembly from Holland. He's a theologian at the Dutch Baptist College. And I just want to end with this. He pointed out something that I hadn't quite picked up before in the Psalms. How often that in the Psalms, at points of maybe you could say orientation when things are all right, that when the psalmist refers to God, he's also in the third person. So it would be, the Lord is my, Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. But how often when the psalmist starts to really dig into the trouble, the Lord is my shepherd turns into you. It becomes personal. And his point was, it's actually in the darkest times is the places where God can be and wants to be most intimate, as we learn to experience God when our feelings and our reality is all over the place. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me, my God and my King. Perhaps God is asking nothing more of you and I this morning, but to come to him, the personal God in our time of need. Not as a distant king or a ruler, but as a you. And my God and my King, would you hear my cry, God? Would you hear my cry for help? Would you act now and do something, because I have had it, my God and my King? Let's worship God together. Let's pray. In a few moments, we're going to sing a song just that is Church of England developed as part of the World Mental Health Day. You'll be invited to sing along to a familiar tune. For now, Father, would you help us to hear the invitation to come to you, to name our pain, to dare to speak. More than anything else, God, help us to know you're present with us. Despite what our feelings are telling us, help us to know your presence. Help us to trust in your goodness, in your character.